I'm going to go on to our second speaker, Dr. John Holohan, who for 18 years has been the director of the Health Policy Research Center at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. He has degrees in political science from the University of Notre Dame and a Ph.D. in economics from Georgetown University. He's written 10 books, 90 papers, 30 briefs, and 24 monographs on topics such as who Medicaid beneficiaries are, how Medicaid benefits and expenditures vary across states, and reasons for the growth in the uninsured. He's presented at 7 state legislatures, and he speaks frequently at meetings of the National Conference of State Legislatures. Now, before we bring in a speaker, we do a background check on them to make sure that they meet one criteria that's really a hallmark of the Family Impact Seminars, and that's their objectivity and nonpartisanship. So in doing this with Dr. Holohan, I searched, and I did have his middle initial, and I got 877 hits. He has done so much writing that there are pages and pages on his writing. In fact, one website ranked his books by readership, so you could see which was the most popular. So when he's not writing, he likes to play tennis, he tells me. So Dr. Holohan, it's time for you to take center court. His topic today is Medicaid a high-cost approach for serving low-income individuals and families?
Thank you, Karen. You're going to have to tell me where you found that, all that information. Okay, I actually retitled this Perspectives on the Medicaid Cost Problem. And what I wanted to cover is four topics. Why is Medicaid spending growing so rapidly? Is Medicaid a high-cost program when you compare it with private alternatives? Has Medicaid been effective? And are there ways that costs have not been could be contained? Let's see if I can work this. Here we go. Medicaid expenditure growth is a big deal, as I'm sure you know, and it's probably why you're here. The growth rates have been enormous, particularly in the last few years, and it's put great pressure on state budgets. These are some U.S. numbers and some numbers for Wisconsin. At the national level, Medicaid spending went from $205.7 billion in 2000 $295.9 billion in 2004. It's pretty close to a 50% growth rate. In other words, you know, that just a huge increase in the size of the program just in 4 years, an average annual growth of 9.5%. I tried to get some Wisconsin numbers together, and they show somewhat lower growth. Something that I saw yesterday made me think that the 2000 number is probably too high. If that's true, then the actual four-year growth rate and the average annual growth rate is somewhat higher than this, and Wisconsin gets closer to the U.S. average. But nonetheless, Wisconsin is experiencing problems similar to those that we're seeing around the country. When we looked at Medicaid spending and how it compared spending growth rates and how it compared to the private those with private insurance, and here we just looked at acute care spending because it's pretty hard to find an alternative for long-term care. Medicaid spending on a per-enrolled basis was growing fairly rapidly, 7%. This is clearly faster than the economy's been growing through these years. But when you compare it to the growth in private spending, the middle bar, you can see that healthcare spending per person with private coverage grew at 9%. Monthly premiums for those with employer-sponsored coverage increased to 12.6%. So even though the Medicaid spending growth has been rapid, it's somewhat less than we're seeing in the private sector. Another way of thinking about this is that Medicaid is facing a problem similar to those of us that have private coverage, and it's actually holding the growth down at somewhat below what private insurers are able to do. But nonetheless, Medicaid's the growth in spending per enrollee is a factor. But the bigger factor over the recent years, and actually going back quite a bit longer, and explaining why Medicaid spending grows is the growth in enrollment. And what this shows on the left-hand side is the growth for the United States. Their spending growth, this is 2000 through 2004, has averaged 8% a year overall, 2.9% for the aged and disabled, which in comparison to children and non-disabled adults at 10% seems quite low, but it's really three times the rate of growth in the population. So it's important, particularly because that population is very expensive. The Wisconsin numbers are similar, a little bit lower, if I have them right, but I think overall population growth in Wisconsin is below the national average, so that probably explains some of that. But when you look at families, that is the children and non-disabled adults, it's pretty close to what's happening in the U.S. The reasons for the enrollment growth, since that's a big driver of cost. For families and children, it's really comes down to the recession, the slowdown in economic growth that we've seen over the last 4 years, and rising health care costs. The recession means that fewer people are working, or they're working at lower-paying jobs, and so without states changing eligibility standards, more people's incomes make them eligible for the program. And the second thing is the growth in health care costs. It's almost 10% per year at a time when wage growth is less than 2.5%. This is affecting employers' willingness to offer coverage, and to the extent that they shift more and more of the cost of premiums onto employees, there's an effect on employees taking up their employer's offers. So both of these are really leading to more people who meet the eligibility standards taking advantage of Medicaid coverage. The age and disabled, there's a lot of reasons. As I said before, this is growing faster than the growth in the overall population. And so there are several reasons for this. I think the increased participation in Medicaid among these populations is likely due to the rising health care costs, where people might forego participating in Medicaid, particularly with the rise in prescription drug costs, really find that they need to enroll in Medicaid in order to get access. Of course, that will change with the Medicare drug benefit, but we're talking about the recent history. The aging of the baby boomers. The problem that is going to affect Social Security and Medicare in a few years has already affected Medicaid. As people age, get over the age of 50, the probability of having a disability grows. That population cohort is really moving through that 50 to 64-year-old band right now, and it's increasing the number of people with disabilities. Medical technology, the ability to save lives but leaving people in a disabled condition in which they remain, become eligible for SSI and medical benefits, particularly through Medicaid, Medicare as well. Increased participation in home and community-based waiver programs. The states have attempted to move people out of nursing homes and other institutions through these programs, finding more people coming on to Medicaid, taking advantage of those services. A couple other things that are not on the list, the increased recognition, particularly among mental disabilities, that these are mental disabilities is resulting in more people enrolling. And the final thing that people bring up all the time is the advocacy among disabled groups to get people enrolled in Medicaid and take advantage of the services that are there. I want to show a slide here about the impact of Medicaid, that Medicaid has had on and the relationship between the decline in employer-sponsored insurance, Medicaid growth, and what might have otherwise happened to the number of uninsured. These are percentage point changes, and if you take a population distributed, all the numbers have to add to 100%. If something changes and you want to look at the new distribution, some things are going to go up and some things have to go down. But on balance, whatever goes, you know, if you have numbers below the line, the others have to increase to compensate it. It doesn't quite do this because I've excluded military and Medicare coverage here. But what you see here, between 2000 and 2004 in Wisconsin, the rate of employer-sponsored insurance fell by almost 10 percentage points. It fell from about 79% to about 69%. This is just huge. It was about double the drop in employer-sponsored coverage that we've seen in the rest of the country. Medicaid picked some of that up with a growth of 3.6 percentage points. The 2.3 is in direct purchase of insurance, either in small group markets or in the individual market. Those changes in Medicaid and direct purchase of insurance were not enough to offset the decline in employer coverage, and we see an increase in the uninsured rate of 3.4 percentage points from 8.5 to a little over 11%. If that Medicaid growth had not occurred, almost all of it would have loaded into the uninsured rate, and you would have had a much bigger increase in the uninsured than you've seen in the state. For children, you have an even larger drop in employer coverage, but a very large increase in Medicaid, 9.4 percentage points. That is primarily because of the Medicaid expansions and the SCHIP program, making it Medicaid coverage much more available for children. And as you can see, there was an increase in the uninsured rate of 1.2 percentage points, but it wasn't statistically significant. among adults, where it's harder to get into Medicaid, there's a drop in employer coverage, a lot much less of an increase in Medicaid, some increase in direct purchase, and a much higher increase in the uninsured rate than we see for kids. But again, less than we otherwise would have seen if it had not been for the Medicaid growth. Okay, second topic, is Medicaid high cost compared to private alternatives? Comparing Medicaid to people with private coverage, even low-income people with private coverage, is difficult because the populations are so different. The Medicaid population is much more likely to be below the poverty level. And here, when I'm talking about low-income people with private coverage, I'm only talking about people with below 200% of poverty. So I'm still talking about a low-income group. But even with that, the Medicaid population is significantly poorer, much less likely to have a high school education, more likely to be single. Looking at health status, the percent of Medicaid adults reporting being in fair or poor health is 37% versus 11% for those with private insurance, about a two-fold difference for kids. If you look at other kinds of conditions, physical and cognitive limitations, you see the same story. On the left, more likely to report being in fair or poor mental health, big differences in social and cognitive limitations, difficulty in lifting, walking, and work, household, and school limitations. So the population is sicker and more disabled for sure. Okay. So as I said, you can find data that will tell you when you look at Medicaid spending on a per-person basis that Medicaid is more costly than those people with private insurance, but you have to remember that we're really talking about different kinds of populations, people with very different conditions and different demographic characteristics. We estimated statistical models, or I did with a colleague, Jack Adley, at the Urban Institute, which controlled for these differences in health status, income, education, and so forth, and sort of allowed us to ask the question, if people really were the same, what would be the difference? So when you control for these factors, you can find out what the difference is due to one kind of insurance relative to another, and then simulate what if the Medicaid population with its characteristics had private coverage. And these are the results, that the Medicaid adult population averaged $3,145. If those same people with those same conditions had private coverage, it would have been $4,410. This is just the use of medical services, doesn't count administrative costs, which would be higher on the private side as well. For children, there's there's also a difference, not as great, and the overall levels of spending are clearly lower. So what this is telling us is that the high medical expenditures then are really in Medicaid are really due to the health conditions of the population as well as to enrollment growth. The next slide just adds to this a little bit, where we just looked at people in fair or poor health. What are the differences in cost there? And there they really are even greater. And I think this is not exactly a positive thing from the perspective of Medicaid. The costs are lower, but I think the reason is that when you're sicker in Medicaid, you have less access to technology specialists and so forth. The primary reason for these differences is provider payment rates. We did some other work to really see how much it was utilization, was it how well providers are paid. It's clearly the latter. And because of that, I think the access to specialists and technologies and new technologies and so forth is affected. So it's not all a good story to be less costly. This figure shows this issue of the high benefit package in Medicaid. If you look at a Medicaid benefit package, there is a very, very long list of things that people have access to. But the fact is that there's not a lot of dollars in that end of the benefit package. And what this shows is that this is from the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. Spending for both the Medicaid population and these low-income people with private insurance that I talked about before. Medicaid averaged $1,752, private insurance $2,253. You can see if you look at the core, what I call the bottom four services along the legend there, prescription drugs, outpatient emergency room care, physician office-based care, and inpatient care, that accounts for about 89% of spending. At the top, dental, other, which other being podiatry, vision, hearing, chiropractor services, hospice is in there, therapies. That accounts for 9% on the Medicaid side, 11% on the private insurance side. In dollars, it's $158 on Medicaid, $248 on the private side. So the key points here are most of the dollars are in sort of the core bread and butter, acute care services, drugs, inpatient care, and so forth. There's not a lot of dollars at the edge of the benefit package, even though the benefit package seems to be rich. Part of this is really, you know, is access to providers that is a longstanding issue with Medicaid. I want to look at some of the evidence on how effective Medicaid has been. The first two slides compare Medicaid adults and children in terms of access and utilization to the uninsured. And what this is telling us is that compared to the uninsured, the Medicaid population is much more likely to have a usual source of care, much less likely to have unmet need for medical and surgical care, dental care, drugs, more likely to have physician visits, dental visits, breast exams, pap smears. For kids, pretty much the same story. More likely to have a usual source of care, less unmet need, more visits, particularly at the bottom, well-child visits. So Medicaid clearly makes a difference relative to being uninsured. How does public coverage compare to private insurance? And by and large, the story here is that for adults, there's no difference. The difference in the usual source of care is not significant, nor is the unmet need for medical care. The one place where there are significant differences and where Medicaid populations are worse off is in dental care. The unmet need for dental care is higher, and the likelihood of having a dental visit is substantially lower. Children. Here there are either no significant differences or actually the Medicaid population is somewhat better off, particularly as you look at the bottom, more likely to have a doctor visit, well-child visit, dental visit. The one place where kids are worse off is they're more likely to have report having an unmet need for drugs. The last part, and I have to move here. Cost containment. I mean, even though I think Medicaid costs have been held down compared with what we see for those of us who have private insurance, there are still issues. All states face them. So cutting Medicaid, I would say, is possible but difficult. One problem you start with is that most reasonable options have been exploited. Vern and I have been doing this for a long, long time, and states have thought of most things and exploited most things, particularly around reimbursement rates and trimming of benefit packages. The second point, the thing that's most often talked about is the optional acute care benefits, particularly for adults. As I showed in the previous slide, there's not a lot of money here. You might save, if you cut it out completely, assuming that you're willing to take on those battles, you'd save at most 10% of acute care. It's a much less percent of all Medicaid spending. And most likely people aren't going to cut them all out, so you're not going to get even that. Cuts in eligibility will work. It will save you money. But it will increase the uninsured. It will affect beneficiary health. It will affect safety net providers. Care will still go to those people, not as much care, but that care will not be supported with federal matching funds. It's certainly a cost containment strategy that will work, but it'll have effects. Drug pricing. I think Vern may talk about this more. Major source of cost growth. It's a real target. I think most policymakers don't find this controversial. Clearly, the drug companies do. This is an area that NGA, the Medicaid Commission, the Bush administration really wants to do something about, and they should. Asset transfers, people transferring assets so that they can go into a nursing home and protect the inheritances of their heirs. Very hard to justify this, that other people should have to pay for this just so that their inheritances can be larger. So it's totally appropriate as a policy target. But studies show the really serious work here is there's a lot of great stories out there, but there's not a lot of money. And the reason is that most nursing home residents who are on Medicaid don't have much in the way of assets, and the amount of transferring, large amount of assets, pretty small. Most of the transferring that goes on is in the $50,000 range. The administration and CBO both estimate the cost from the provisions that they propose wouldn't really save a lot of money. They propose $4.5 billion. Over 5 years, which is about 3% of nursing home spending, not a lot. How many of these do you have?
This is it.
This is it. Okay. All
right. Cost, the hook. Yeah.
cost sharing. You know, make people pay more for services. And the idea is you reduce the inappropriate use of services. The research shows that you're going to reduce both inappropriate and appropriate use. I think here the issue is targeting. Most people want to protect a really low-income population, also want to protect those who are really sick. The problem is that the distribution of health spending is so skewed with small numbers of people having large expenses that when you really think about it hard and try to protect the people with a lot high levels of spending relative to their incomes, and as well as the people who are the lowest income, you end up with not a lot of targets. And so, as I said here, if it's well-designed, and protects the poorest and the sickest, then the savings aren't great. Otherwise, it can be punitive. Where I think policy needs to go is in dealing with these high-cost cases, and it's the people that are near the end of life, but it's also people with chronic conditions that are very expensive to deal with. And what this slide is saying, if you look at across on the left-hand side, it's the distribution of enrollees. At the top is the 4% of the highest spending. The sickest people, the highest spenders, spend 49% of all Medicaid dollars. The next 4% spends another 16%. So 8% of the Medicaid enrollees are spending 65% of all dollars. And really need to get a handle on those dollars. And things like the cutting optional benefits and tinkering around with cost sharing just don't deal with that problem. There are people now who worry a lot about disease management programs and we know a lot more about how to do that, but I think that's where the future is, and that's where the money is. My concluding comment is that states are pretty limited in what they can do with this. This problem, and I think for legislators that have the ear of people at the federal level, this problem has to be dealt with more through the federal government. The people in Washington power right now are probably not going to do it, but that's what really has to happen. The Medicaid at the federal level really has to take, particularly the dual eligibles, the NGA has been pushing this for a long time, has to take more of the burden of Medicaid off of the role of the states. States are just not going to be able to deal with the growing enrollment that's coming because of both of the demographic shifts towards an older and more disabled population and the drops in employer-sponsored insurance that I think are likely to continue. With that, I got there before you put up your stop sign.
Any questions for Dr. Hollihan?
Yes.
A decade ago, the state of Oregon, under the impetus of a governor who was also a physician, implemented a program whereby they assessed the effectiveness of various treatments, including what the outcomes were, stage of life, so forth, what would happen, and tried to appropriate dollars according to the results. That program has...
Where was this?
In Oregon.
In Oregon.
The state of Oregon. I think it was Governor Kickhofer. Right. I'm not sure I got the name exactly right. But it seemed to me that made a lot of sense. It sort of focused your money on where you got the best results. Are you familiar with that? And can you address at all what the history of that program has been?
Vern and Martha may be able to do better. My sense of what happened there is that they identified a whole series of diagnosis and treatment groups and said, below this line, we're not going to cover it. And, but then at the same time, they went into managed care in a large way. I think they used the budget that would allow them to fund their approved categories to set capitation rates and then let managed care plans make decisions within that. The one issue that I've always thought about is that within any one of these diagnosis and treatment program groups, you could have people with a very low probability of a good outcome. And for those below the line, the ones you don't want to fund, there could be some ones within that set, some with a higher probability of outcome. So I'm not sure. It seems like, in a sense, a pretty crude tool. It's something that I think we've always relied on physicians to make those judgments. So I don't know. It's worth looking at what people think the outcome has been that, but I think there's some fairly obvious problems with it. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Senator Wilson.
Thank you. On your slides, when you were comparing Medicaid cost and private insurance, were you just talking about what MA reimburses for the treatment or the true cost in that? Because there's a big difference. I'm wondering if in reality the cost is a lot higher than what MA reimburses, or if you were using the true cost.
No, it's the payments. Right, you're right. I mean, Medicaid, to the extent Medicaid is underpaying, right, it's that gets reflected. That is I made that point that I think one reason that there are those differences is the Medicaid payment rates are low, and or alternatively, the private rates are high.
If you were to really look at the true dollars, how would have you looked at that and how that would change that chart, saying maybe per person an MA is a lot higher than private or not?
Well, I mean, if you said if you had everybody pay the same relation to costs, then they should be identical because you're paying you're making the payment rates relative to cost are the same for a population where you've controlled for differences in health status. So it should be the same. But the Medicaid is paying less than costs, but costs are not some exogenous thing that's just hits a hospital or hits a doctor's office. I mean, there is control over that. And the most successful cost containment policies that we've had in this country through any payer have been through provider payment policies. And, and oftentimes it means that providers are not getting paid what they'd like to get paid, but, so they have less in the way of resources, have to make a variety of decisions. But I don't see any, so Medicaid probably pays too little. Private sector is probably paying too much. The whole issue of how much ought to be paid is a more complicated issue. But my main point is that, I think we think of, for low-income people, that there's a sense that we shouldn't be talking about the same tier of medicine. And I think Medicaid, by and large, achieves that. And as a result, it saves money.
Representative Sherman. Hi. You said that tightening up on divestment would only save about 3%
of nursing home spending.
That's actually a pretty fair amount of money. If it's increasing 9%, that would be a third of the increase.
No. It's 3% of something that maybe, let's say it's accounting for 15% of Medicaid spending. So it's 3% of something. Let's say nursing home spending is 15% of the, maybe it's more than that, 20% of the Medicaid pie. So you're saving 3% of 20%.
So, and you said anecdotally that you think it's mostly transferring small amounts, and I assume anecdotally because the transfer has to be at least 30 months before application, and thus there's no way to really trace it. Since if it's beyond the 30 months, it doesn't get reported. Because I think there's a whole industry of divestment in the legal profession. There's a subspecialty. There's people who do nothing else for a living except divestment. My suspicion is it's a lot more than you think it is.
Well, there have been studies that have shown, there are databases that follow people, have data on assets, incomes, follow them over a long period of time. And all I can say is that this is what they show. The administration and the Congressional Budget Office both believe that that these are not large amounts of money that are being divested. Most high-income people with significant amount of assets never want to be in Medicaid. They want to finance, and they can finance long-term care themselves, and they do. Either most likely staying in a home, in a nice assisted living facilities, or a high-quality nursing home, and never go near Medicaid. It's people with modest amount of assets. And by and large, they are spending, what some of these studies, there's an excellent study, review of all these studies done by a woman named Ellen O'Brien at Georgetown, which I would encourage you to look at. And it, by and large, people try to protect their assets in order to buy the services that they will need to keep them out of nursing homes. That's the most common pattern. But I agree with you. There is a lot of talk about attorneys who do nothing but worry about this. So there's a disconnect. But I think there is a large number of people who are suspicious of that, including the federal government and congressional budget office, suspicious about the absolute dollar magnitude that's at stake here.